Coming up today, super fast bats, what Donald Trump's election victory means for science and technology, and because we really need some good news, a very special snail finds love. You're listening to episode 293 of the YGK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, technology, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Wollaston.
Hello.
Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
And Liat Clark.
Hello.
It's been a year.
Hello after a year off.
with more gusto.
Redo, guys. No.
It's good to have you back.
It's good to be back. I'm very excited.
It's been a while since you've been in this cupboard.
I've missed it, so it looks really organised. Jeremy's really stepped it up.
Everything has changed. Okay,
so where I'm stepping.
Who wants to do their fact first? Amelia?
I'll go first. So, this week I learned that aubergine is in fact not a vegetable, despite it often featuring in a main course and not in a dessert. It is actually a berry. And in America, it is called eggplant because they named it after the white and yellow versions found in the 18th century, and people thought it looked like a goose egg.
That's a really interesting fact.
That's a bloody big berry.
That is, yeah, that's a huge
that's
berry.
That's insane.
If anyone doesn't know what an aubergine or eggplant is, if you've ever been sent a certain type of picture on any of your instant messaging apps, you'll know what emoji I'm talking about.
Nice.
It's the emoji.
Yes. I learned this week, actually, I'm going to get you to guess. How many patents did Thomas Edison have?
Oh.
It's a lot.
Oh. I would say 93.
Okay.
I will go with 552, James Templeton.
Mm. Okay.
I have no idea.
I'll go middle of the road and say about 240.
He's way more patenty than that.
I thought I was being ridiculous.
Globally, he had 2,332 patents. And in the US alone, he had 1,093.
I guess he thought one would stick.
Yeah. And you could just keep inventing.
Yeah.
Go Edison.
Was he a patent troll?
Yes, he was the original patent troll.
I don't think I've ever had one good idea, let alone thousands.
Oh, Vicky, you have a lot. You just haven't had the foresight to
there's still
have
time.
Down.
So, Leah, what did you learn this week?
It might feel as though the end is nigh, but don't worry. The actual apocalypse is a long way off. The universe will be ultimately destroyed, but a team from the Technical University of Lisbon has published a study this week saying that they believe it's going to tear itself apart, not die in a big freeze, which Vicky wrote about a few weeks ago. Dark matter is accelerating the expansion of the universe, and according to this team, the tearing apart scenario will happen if dark energy takes on a phantom form, which gets denser as the universe grows.
Yay.
Sad times, but you know, not as sad as Trump.
Amelia, what did you learn this week? Oh no, we've had you. It's Vicky.
To introduce what's actually going to end up being a bit of an animal special of this podcast, how long do you think a giraffe is pregnant for?
2 years.
Definitely. Yeah, I'd say maybe in between 18 months and 2 years.
Yeah, at least a year.
It's actually 15 months, or to be precise, between 453 and 464 days. So giraffes give birth in a calving ground, and mothers will often return to where they were born to have their own babies.
Aww.
It's a bit nicer than the end of the universe being ripped apart.
Sorry.
And this is definitely a bit nicer than the end of the universe. So first story this week, I'll just say snails.
Oh, it's Jeremy the mutant snail. So this week has felt a little bit intense in terms of news. So it's a joy to learn that Jeremy, the left-handed snail, has found love.
What?
So Jeremy...
So snails don't have hands.
So Jeremy was found in a compost heap early this year, and geneticists at the University of Nottingham realised that he was actually sinistral, which means the spirals on his shell rotate in the opposite way to similar mollusks or normal. Or I say normal. I don't want to say that Jeremy's not normal. Poor Jeremy. Which means he has a left-handed or anti-clockwise shell rather than a clockwise one. So the researchers have said this is so rare, they've even called him like one in a million. Oh, but when the geneticists thought they're going to have to start studying him, they realised that really to study his genetic makeup, they're going to need more than one of Jeremy, because otherwise they won't know whether it's a one-off or whether it's something that can be inherited. So they use the hashtag on Twitter, hashtag snail love. And the researchers embarked on a mission to find Jeremy a mate.
I was going to say, it says one in a million, but we've probably stood on an awful lot of Jeremy's relatives.
I can't even think about that. It's like the universe ending.
So why couldn't he just get busy with any old snail?
Well, aside from the fact that his snail has this anti-clockwise pattern, what it actually means is that his genitals are reversed. His genitals are on the wrong... I say wrong side again. I keep being really mean to Jeremy. But his genitals are on the opposite side to normal. So he needs to find a female who also has genitals on the opposite side, because otherwise they just won't fit properly.
Okay. So they found love. Jeremy has found a mate.
It wasn't just found one. There's a bit of a menage a trois going on, because they actually found two mates for Jeremy. One of them was in Suffolk and one of them was in Spain.
This is scandalous.
And obviously, I think the researchers decided to go for the one that was nearest in Suffolk. So the snail in Suffolk is imaginatively called Lefty, and it's owned by a snail collector called Jade Sanchez Melton. So Jeremy's been taken to Ipswich to meet Lefty, and Jade is going to be observing them for around 2 weeks to actually see if they mate. Because let's be honest, only because you found someone who you can mate with, but doesn't mean you want to.
True, yes.
Did Jeremy really mind?
We'll find out.
I think he'll be all right.
Poor Jeremy's probably been looking for love for such a long time that he'll just go for it.
And I presume we're going to be keeping up to date with all of the developments.
All of the developments in the Jeremy love triangle.
Snail sex story. Our second story this week is also about animals, and it's about super speedy bat Amelia.
Yes, this is really exciting, really. So Brazilian free-tailed bats are now officially the fastest flying animals.
How fast are Brazilian... What are they? Brazilian free-tailed bats?
Yes, they can reach the horizontal speed of 100 miles per hour. Yeah, really, really fast. So the key part to this story is the fact that it's a horizontal speed. So other birds can reach like super fast diving speeds. So the peregrine falcons can reach a speed of up to 186 miles per hour.
But they're just falling.
Exactly. Mm. They do have gravity
on their side.
Exactly. Whereas the Brazilian free-tailed bats can just go 100 miles per hour, just zooming through the air.
That's so quick.
So a group of scientists went to the Brazilian rainforest and measured a load of bats.
Actually, this was some research done by the University of Tennessee and a couple of German universities. I forgot to write down where they actually found the bats.
It's fine.
But I think they also are called the Mexican free-tailed bats, so I think you can find them in different places.
So how do you measure the speed of a bat?
Right, so...
Sounds like the start of a joke.
The scientists caught a couple of the bats and attached radio transmitters to their backs using surgical glue. And then using mobile receivers on a small aircraft, they tracked the transmitters. And this meant they were able to track the flight paths of the animals and measure their speeds that way.
It's very elaborate.
Yeah, it is really. But
they used glue. They stuck them
all
with glue.
They said that it didn't hurt them too much because it was surgical glue, which isn't supposed to hurt. And also they came off after a couple of days, so it wasn't too hard.
Also, just think the extra weight that transmitter would have put on them. Maybe they can go even faster than 100 miles per hour.
Well, this could be a thing because the female bats that they caught were only about 11 to 12 grams. So, you know, really, really small bats that they're doing. So, yeah, maybe with the added weight... if they took the added weight off, they could probably go even faster.
So it's to do with their shape? They're very aerodynamic, I presume.
Yeah, they have an aerodynamic body shape and longer than average wings compared to other bats, which is what they think helps them fly faster. And they are pretty tiny. You know, 11 to 12 grams makes them quite small compared to normal bats. So that can be a thing as well. And also, they did say that maybe they were helped by things like a headwind can make them fly faster and a tailwind can make them slow down, which is just the same as normal birds, normal aeroplanes.
Oh, well done, Brazilian free-tailed bats.
Yes.
Way to go, bats.
Super tiny bats can fly really, really fast.
Liat, our third story this week isn't about animals. Last week we had our two Wired events, Wired 2016 and Wired Next Generation. It was exhausting, but it was brilliant. You've picked out some highlights.
Yes, I have indeed. I mean, we had a ridiculous group of speakers like we do every year. We had the guy who discovered the Ebola virus, the first private space tourist. But I was just going to talk through a couple of my favourites and then talk to you guys about yours. First is Heston Blumenthal, who's obviously very well known, but he spoke at Wired Next Generation, which is probably my favourite event of all our events. It's our event for 12 to 18-year-olds. And he really, his message was really one of inclusivity. He talked about upending our entire education system, making sure that it's about encouraging students to speak up without fear of humiliation, to put their ideas forward without being afraid of failure, essentially. He spoke about how he's always been inspired by childhood memories in his work and kind of through his multi-sensory dishes, he's brought that to the fore and through a lot of his fantastical themes. So he was urging the audience to hold on to that childhood curiosity, continue asking questions, and not let that sense of adventure and wonderment about the world be beaten out of them, essentially, by the British education system, which I thought was a good lesson.
Or grumpy adults, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the lovely thing about Wired Events is it can go from Heston Blumenthal doing weird things with Skittles and Coca-Cola one minute to having an astronaut on stage the next.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we had some pretty heavy going speakers as well. We had a section that was about refugees, I believe it was called
Refugee Crisis or yeah.
Disrupted World. And there was one individual called Abdelaziz Al Hamza, who is the co-founder of Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently. And he gave probably one of the most powerful speeches across the conference. I think over the years, the speakers that stay with people have been the ones that we hear about who are making a real, incredible, tangible difference to the world we live in. And this is often scientists, you know, using new cancer treatments, roboticists creating bionic limbs that liberate people with disabilities. But he was a citizen, or is a citizen journalist in Syria and now working in Europe. And he's been working to expose human rights abuses carried out by ISIS in Raqqa, which is in northern Syria. He spoke about the work and what he's been doing remotely and when he was there, and really shared some harrowing realities of the work being done there, and the fact that his colleagues, his friends, family members of colleagues have been captured and executed by ISIS. And he stood on the stage talking about the most unimaginable things. We're all sitting there at this conference, you know, seeing people come from all over the world talking about the science, technology, innovations, and here's this man who's, you know, literally put his life and the lives of his friends in danger every year in order to kind of, you know, make sure the rest of the world knows what's going on. And it was pretty harrowing, but also very important.
And his organization operates where traditional journalism can't really go because it's so incredibly dangerous and you have to be so embedded in the community. So there'll be times where the correspondents that he works with, he won't hear from them for weeks and weeks, and then getting the information from them safely out of the country or safely onto the internet is just so difficult.
Of course, and I think it's become more and more difficult as time's gone on because ISIS has, you know, clued into what was happening. At first, they were able to post videos, and then immediately they realised that people were being identified in these videos and being killed as a result. Then they were using different tactics to blur people out. But, you know, it's incredibly, incredibly hard, and yet they are continuing to do it. And it's, you know, really important now more than ever to make sure people are still reading about this and hopefully doing, well, I don't know what anyone's doing. The world is feeling so sad this week, but he is doing something, and his, you know, the people he's working with are doing something incredible. And it's for the rest of us to frankly sit there in the conference. I think no one knew how to respond.
Well, they got a standing ovation, didn't they?
Well, yeah, they responded in that way.
Just,
I guess.
It was, and I think the problem, you see these Syria reports all the time on the news, and you get a little bit numb to them. And as much as we don't want to, and as much as you would like to read around them, you sort of see the same sorts of shots all the time.
Exactly.
And being in our Western bubble over here, it's very easy to not realise that. To see someone on stage not just talk about the things he's doing, and let's be honest, he doesn't have to do this stuff. He's doing this because he feels like he's doing a service, and a really good one.
And he could very easily, and we would have all understood it if he did this, he tried to make it work. Literally in the first week, he lost colleagues and people were being killed in the most horrific ways, and yet he carried on.
Yeah.
And he's still going on, and that is just a testament to, you know, how strong people can be and how much he cares about his country, about his fellow men and women, children living there, and how much he wants to keep making a difference in whatever way he can.
Who else caught your eye?
Well, I thought I'd end on a hopeful note. Bertrand Piccard, who's also the cover story of the current issue of Wired. He obviously, you know, flew around the world in his solar power plane solo. He was a complete dude. Every single sentence out of his mouth was filled with inspiration and hope, and he just completely slayed it. And I thought, James, seeing as you met him and interviewed him over the course of a few days, you should really tell us more about how amazing he is.
Well, he
stole my heart.
He's a pretty romantic guy. So he's flown around the world twice and done a first twice. So he went around the world in 1999 in a hot air balloon with a British balloon pilot, and then a couple of years ago he went around the world in a solar powered plane. It took him a couple of years to do, multiple legs. And there he didn't use a drop of fuel. So he said that the thing that he realized when he went around the world in the hot air balloon, that the only limit that he had was the fuel. So being the kind of person that he is, he went, okay, so now I need to do it with no fuel.
I'd like to be limitless. It's basically what Bertrand says whenever he looks in the mirror every day.
Yeah.
I want to be limitless. And then he just makes that reality happen.
He's so dreamy.
Yeah, he's a pretty dreamy guy. And now he's completed that mission. He's become a huge, huge advocate for clean technologies and for doing something actionable against climate change. So he says that people think about global warming in the wrong way. They see it as a problem, which it obviously is, but he's saying, well, there's all of these solutions. If I can fly around the world in a plane and not use any fuel, then people can make changes in their lives, and governments can make changes to legislation, and companies can behave in ways that will allow us to not solve climate change, but certainly improve it and start to work to keep the planet in better shape. It's a really, really amazing story. As I said, it's in the current issue of Wired, and he was really, really great at Wired 2016. Really, yeah. It was a really good way to start the second day.
He, like the previous speaker I was talking about, just completely typified the events for me, because you come away, you don't forget how you felt when they were talking, and he just, I think the whole audience was just filled with like hope and excitement and let's go out and do something.
Yeah.
And that feeling like we can do something, we don't have to be apathetic. That's why we're all here, because we want to do something, change something.
Amelia, what were your favourite talks?
Definitely along the lines of what Liat was saying, the session about refugees and immigration was really interesting. And I think one of my favourite talks of the event was from Regina Catramboni. She's Italian, so I apologise if I've pronounced her name wrong. I'm not very good at Italian. So she's an Italian entrepreneur, and her husband created, I think, the first NGO at sea called MOAS. And they rescue refugees in the Italian Sea, basically, from the Mediterranean. So she spoke about how her family were out on a boat one day and they ended up rescuing loads of refugees. And basically that was where the NGO came from. And the moment when she told the crowd that they'd saved 30,000 people so far, everyone stood up and was clapping. And it was one of those good, you know, Wired 2016 inspirational, great moments. And it was really amazing to see the work that she's doing and how positive it is. And just like, I
cried so much at our events over that weekend. Not just tears of sadness, like tears of joy, just absolute tears of joy. I mean, my favourite one was Samantha Payne. She spoke at both of our events, actually. And she brought an 11-year-old girl called Tilly. And so Samantha Payne is one of the co-founders of Open Bionics, and they're trying to make it easier for people to get prosthetics. But also they're looking at prosthetics in a completely different way. So it's not just about, oh, here's a limb. It's like if a child wants a new limb, let's give them a superhero limb. And that was the whole thread of her whole talk. So Tilly comes on with this bionic arm and she's doing sort of fist bumps and she's doing the okay sign and she's moving her hands. And I choked up so much during that. It was brilliant.
Yeah, and it's really amazing technology. So they've got a partnership with Disney, so you can get Iron Man themed masks and Star Wars, arms and Star Wars themed ones. And it's the idea that prostheses can often be quite ugly. The ones that you tend to think of when people get them from a hospital, the traditional prostheses, they're not designed to look cool. but these ones are. And you can see the way the kids react to them. They're awesome.
But also the ability she had with it. It was so natural and the movements were really nuanced. So I think she actually had more skills than Iron Man, the real Iron Man. More, you know, capabilities with the fingers and the wrist movement everything. It was really impressive that they've created something, exciting and kind of a conversation piece for her in her life where it's not something she wants to hide, but just something
she's
really
proud of
cool
it.
That's part of her.
And Samantha also explained that Open Bionics had sent a 3D printer design file across the world. So they sent it from the UK to the USA, and a guy there who needed a prosthesis printed it out at home and then had an arm.
I know. So I should mention, actually, we had our inaugural Wired Audi Innovation Awards last night, and Samantha Payne and Open Bionics won the social innovation. Because it's that thing, it's that she's not just doing it to make money, she's doing it to make a difference. And she, so all the source code is going to be open source. So anyone's going to, in theory, be able to just go and print their own limb.
And it will drive down the cost dramatically. Prostheses are very, very, very expensive, certainly the advanced ones. And this is making it accessible and something that people can use and have access to, which is really, really amazing. If you weren't there, and we know a few of the podcast listeners was because you were nice enough to come up and say hello as we were frantically writing up all the talks. But if you weren't there, you can watch all of the talks online. We're going to be posting videos over the next couple of weeks, but you can also read the reports that we wrote up on the talks. It's all on wired.co.uk. Our final story this week is somewhat inevitably about the US election. On the 20th of January 2017, Donald Trump, if you haven't heard, will take office as the 45th president of the United States. Through months of campaigning, Trump has been criticized for not releasing policies on a number of key issues, ranging from climate change and science funding to encryption and cybersecurity. So I had a very fun day after no sleep, staying up all night to watch the US election, working out exactly where he stands on some of the issues that we consider to be most important to Wired readers. And it's really, really difficult because the man flip-flops like mad.
You're a real fan of self-flagellation, aren't you? You stayed up all night and then you spent the day writing about the misery that is the future.
I'll be honest there. I think I pushed James into that misery.
Yeah, it was lovely. So we should start with climate change, because this is probably the starkest one. So Trump's campaign website makes no mention of environmental issues. He's described man-made climate change as a hoax invented by the Chinese. And in May 2016, he said he would cancel the Paris Climate Change Agreement. He opposes environmental regulations, arguing that they are economically damaging. So there's that.
This is why we need Bertrand.
This is why we need Bertrand.
When you were talking about Bertrand, I was like, why isn't he the advisor in every government across the globe? I mean, if you had him in a room with you when you were debating policy, there's no way you'd walk out
you'd
of that room
without
being like, Bertrand, let's just build everything with solar panels. Like, you can't say no.
Yes, or alternatively, so Trump is rumoured to be lining up a guy called Myron Abel, or Ebel, to head up a transition team for the Environmental Protection Agency. Ebel is a well-known climate change denier, so there's that as well. Fun stuff.
If this happens, it's completely absurd. There couldn't be more science to tell us what the reality is. I can't even finish a sentence. No,
we'll move
that
on.
That won't happen.
So trade, when it comes to unfettered free trade, Donald Trump isn't really a typical Republican. So he's not opposed to the principle of free trade. But he said that US trade must be for the benefit of United States jobs and industries. So he'd be against things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal and could withdraw from other similar trade deals if he thinks that the US isn't getting what it deserves. And this is somewhat typical. In June 2016, he likened the Trans-Pacific Partnership to rape. He said, it's a rape of our country. It's a harsh word, and that's it. Rape of our country, he said.
Wow.
And this... I was wondering, should we include trade in this? Is it something that's relevant? But you think the amount of companies that we write about that are American and do huge, huge quantities of business in Europe and are very, very reliant on good relationships between the United States and the European Union and the UK, etc. This could really, really change things.
Well, someone actually said, said to me the day after the election, he messaged me and just said, I don't know why everyone in the UK is going on about Trump. It doesn't make any difference to us. And I replied, but that's really naive of you.
really naive to not think that one of the most powerful countries in the whole world, if they make a decision that impacts trade, that's not going to ripple across the whole world.
Yes, and seeing as they caused the financial crisis by giving out bad mortgages, and that went right around the world and is still having a really big impact today. It gets even more difficult to look at what Donald Trump means for very, very tech-specific issues such as encryption and cybersecurity. Trump's policies around encryption and cybersecurity are thin. In February 2016, he called on people to boycott Apple until it complied with the US government and unlocked the iPhone used by the San Bernardino shooters. He said, first of all, Apple ought to give authorities the security of that phone. He then said that they should boycott it and said, Tim Cook is living in a world of make-believe. I would come down so hard on him, you have no idea. His head would be spinning all the way back to Silicon Valley.
I'd like to see him. He's not going to put in practice anything he preaches. Can you imagine Tim Cook raising an eyebrow at him like, you moron, you need us.
I should imagine. At the time, I think Apple came out and said that they joined a long list of, and they were proud to be on this list of companies that had rubbed up against Donald Trump. But now they've got to behave. You know, he's the commander in chief of the country that they rely on for a lot of their success. So that's going to be an interesting
fight. Yeah, but I think they'd use every legal means open to them to fight any kind of push like that. It's not, you know, he likes to talk big, but there's no chance they would be able to relinquish if the law's on their side.
Yes, and unlike a lot of things, there is actually a section of Trump's campaign website, the policy section, and within that there's a section called headed up cybersecurity, and it says that Trump would order an immediate review of all US cyber defenses and vulnerabilities, although it doesn't really give any details of what that review would be or why he would want to do it. Moving on, science. Trump has been described as the most anti-science president in the history of the United States. And a very, very senior scientist, Michael Lebel, director of public affairs for the American Physical Society, said that Trump's victory would be very, very severe for, have very, very severe consequences for the scientific community. But his policies are just so thin on science. So while he's a climate change denier, and obviously his policies around immigration are really, really problematic for the scientific community, which relies on people coming from all over the world and collaborating in that open and free trade of people and knowledge, he said things like the US has to be good at science and good at space and good at technology. But when pressed, he tends to just change the subject.
I think there is one quite big ray of hope here, which is that he hasn't, that anything could happen, nothing's set in stone, and he doesn't really follow through with anything except for the unfortunate I'm going to run for president thing.
He followed through with that.
He's not exactly someone that has stood by his word and is a reliable when it comes to his word. So that's the only thing I'm holding.
But the problem here is that science really, really does rely on funding, both private and public. And if he cuts taxes, which he will, then an awful lot of money that science would be getting, it might not get. And that can be very, very damaging because if research is stopped, it's more expensive to get it going again. So there's that. Space. Donald Trump said, I will free NASA from the restriction of serving primarily as a logistics agency for low Earth orbit activity, he said back in October 2016. He said that NASA should refocus its mission on space exploration, and under a Trump administration, Florida and America will lead the way into the stars. So he's a big fan of private investment in space, so companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin.
Yeah.
Should be doing all of the quote-unquote easy stuff, and NASA should refocus on stuff a bit further away. I'm going to finish on two that are, without wanting to be biased, very, very depressing. On abortion, Donald Trump thinks that abortion should be illegal. In March 2016, he said women who have them should receive some form of punishment. When pressed, he didn't say if that punishment should be a fine or a prison sentence. He since stepped back from those remarks, but he later did say his position had not changed. He's since suggested perhaps that doctors should be punished, or he hadn't really said how. Confusingly, in October 1999, he said he was very pro-choice, when asked about abortion rights.
Well, he also used to be a Democrat, so...
Yes, that was when he was a Democrat. And finally, on immigration and refugees, this is a really, really key Trump policy, and it has implications for pretty much every topic that we've talked about on his policies. So he said that he wants to, as we all know, create a 2,000-plus-mile wall along the US-Mexico border. He wants a reduction in legal immigration and has called for a forced deportation of more than 11 million undocumented migrants living in the United States in December 2015 in the wake of the San Bernardino terrorist attack. He said that there should be a total and complete shutdown of the country's borders to all Muslims. Both San Bernardino shooters are US citizens. On refugees, Trump has said that his administration would suspend all immigration from Syria and Libya, and that those looking to enter the US would be subject to an extreme vetting process. What that vetting process would be is unclear. And this is really annoying. That's probably the best word I can come up with without being outrageously rude. The US has some of the strictest and most difficult checks and measures for refugees and immigrants in the world. It can take years to get approved. You're looked at by various government agencies. You are heavily, heavily vetted. And he made the suggestion that the United States doesn't know who it's letting in. So you're ending up with these Trojan horses in your country, and they're sort of sleeper cells waiting to strike at the heart of America. And it's a lie. The US has very, very good idea about everyone it lets into its country. So, yes.
But I think that was the problem throughout the whole of this, is that he wasn't elected on policies that have any substance. There's anything that you can really talk about. So, in a way, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, sometimes it would have been better if he had a negative policy, but he told you what it was.
Yep.
By being completely vague, people are buying into something that could go either way, and that's more dangerous than anything else.
At the same time, he's hedged his bets, so he doesn't actually have to follow through with any of this. There's no firm plan of action here, and frankly, I can't believe it would take this man 4 years, probably take him 50 years to actually have any contribution to a piece of policy change. So hopefully he would never get round to it. It's much like Brexit, though, how you're talking. You know, the campaigners had, you know, nice populist arguments that were completely offensive to half the population, and they had no facts to back them up.
Well, Roland Manthorpe on the magazine, he did an amazing piece, actually. He did it before the election took place, talking about attention economy and talking about how Trump and the Brexit campaign were clickbait campaigns. And you're looking at how actually attention nowadays is worth a lot more than money. So Trump was making these statements. They were outrageous. He was getting on the front page of all the websites, all the magazines, all the newspapers, and then he was getting the attention that he wanted. And I think in an interview, he tweeted something completely outrageous and someone questioned him on it. And he said, oh, well, I don't really know that, but it got your attention, didn't it? And that's the way that it seems to be going. But he hasn't got any policies. We're voting for people based on personality or based on how much attention they're giving.
One of his books that he wrote, I think maybe 20 years ago or more, he explains exactly that kind of tactic. So that he posed the problem, okay, I want to get an advert in the New York Times. Why would I pay however much it is for a four-page ad in the New York Times when I can say something really effing dumb and they'll print it and people will read it? People don't read adverts necessarily, so he can get all the coverage he wants, all the promotion he wants for free just by saying something dumb.
And I, to try and take something positive out of this situation, because it's done now, we need to try and think about that. Hopefully there will be some positives, is I think maybe he did just say these effing stupid things to get into office. And actually, he doesn't believe them in the way that he does. I mean, I'd like to think that was the case. I'm not saying that necessarily is, but I'd like to think that's in the case. What I'd also like, a positive thing from this, is that I'm really hoping that it stops this voter apathy. People have seen Brexit happen. They've seen Trump get as a president. And the majority of people wanted these. So if there's anyone out there who is a minority in that group or who actually didn't want this to happen but didn't vote, I'm hoping that next time when it comes up to it, they'll go, right, my vote does count. I need to do something about this. So I'm not saying that there's the negative things that we've talked about don't count, but I'm hoping there will be some positives that come out of this.
Especially when you look at the numbers in some of the really, really close states like New Hampshire and Wisconsin. He won by just thousands. I think in New Hampshire, he won by just a few hundred votes.
Yeah.
And that gets you a good number of electoral votes and you're off and away. So what looks like a comprehensive victory and is a comprehensive victory is decided by these very, very narrow margins in key swing states. And people don't realise that. It looks like he's absolutely trounced Clinton. Whereas actually it was pretty close. It's just the way the Electoral College works, because she's won the popular vote, right? She got more votes than him.
Yeah, and there was an interesting thing that said Mitt Romney actually in 2012 got more votes than Trump did, but it's obviously just to do with the electoral system, the Electoral College and things, and that's the way it translates into government.
And the turnout was also lower, so 6 million voters disappeared. It was, the lowest turnout in a number of elections.
I think four or five or something like that. Yeah. The last four or five cycles.
Don't want to be a downer after you were so positive. But yeah, the lowest turnout, considering how much press has, you know, it's like the most debated election in my short life. Well,
but also the two candidates with the lowest popularity ratings. They both have negative approval ratings with the US public. So,
and the fear is that people say, well, you know, I mean, Trump's in power, Brexit happens, what the heck's the point? Like, that's the danger, that it doesn't actually inspire people. It gives them more fuel to be apathetic, is my fear.
But it also goes back to what my friend was saying about how it doesn't affect people in the UK. That's such a naive way to think about it, because it really does. It really does. The fact you said that it's been the most covered, I can't remember being this gripped by Obama's last campaign or any campaign really in my lifetime. And it's not an age thing. I would have been old enough to take on what was going on in those ones, but it just didn't have that level of attention.
This election, I have read some places, has been called the social media election. Obviously, Obama used a lot of social media in order to raise money for his campaign originally in 2008. But now that social media is so much bigger, I mean, Twitter was pretty young in 2007, 2008 when Obama was doing his campaigning then. So, but now everyone's using it. And I know we had a great piece about Twitter bots on the website. I can't remember everything, so make sure you read it. And it's just kind of showing how, you know, that splurge of information that is going on everywhere is obviously having some kind of impact.
Well, there was a standout statistic from that Twitter bot piece that said 4 million election-related tweets were sent from 4,000 bots. And if you're on Twitter and someone posts something that you either agree with or you disagree with, you'll either get involved in an argument with them or you'll retweet it because you believe in it. You don't then have time. The way that Twitter works, you don't have then time to go, oh, is this a bot? Is this a human? So suddenly you've got this bot sort of jumping on these hashtags and sort of taking them away from what they're meant to be, or creating hashtags to spread these views. That's what's worrying as well, that people don't, you just don't know whether you're dealing with a bot or not.
Everyone take a deep breath. Think happy thoughts. I promise that we won't talk about Donald Trump on the next podcast, and we probably won't talk about Brexit either. If you've got any thoughts on anything that we've talked about, it would be really great to get your views on Trump, his impact, especially if you're American, his impact on things that are important to Wired, to science and technology and all that kind of thing. Do get in touch. We're at Wired UK on Twitter, or individually, I'm at Jay Temperton. Vicky, you are?
At Vicky Wollaston.
Amelia.
At AmeliaX1.
Liat.
At Liat Clark.
And follow us all if you don't. Everyone likes some followers. And then we can spread some more disinformation.
Or you can help us find more love mates for Jeremy. You can retweet these stories.
And then Jeremy can be a very happy snail.
Yeah, as long as Jeremy's okay.
Okay, we will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.